Neither was an article in a newspaper, but Ryan knew from his own experience that much purported news was made up from whole cloth. But nobody ever said that writing a biography was easy. His first book, Doomed Eagles, had been, in retrospect, a much easier project. Bill Halsey, Fleet Admiral USN, had fascinated him since reading the man's own autobiography as a boy. He'd commanded naval forces in battle, and while that had seemed exciting to a boy of 10 years, it was positively frightening to a man of 32, because now he understood the things that Halsey didn't discuss in full. The unknowns, having to trust intelligence information without really knowing where it came from, how it was gathered, how it was analyzed and processed, how it was transmitted to him, and whether or not the enemy was listening in. Ryan was now in that loop, and having to wager his life on the work that he did himself was frightening as hell. Rather more so, actually, to be wagering the lives of others whom he might or, more likely, might not know. There was a joke he remembered from his time in the Marine Corps, Ryan thought, as the green English countryside slid past his window. The motto of the intelligence services was, "We bet your life." That was now his business. He had to wager the lives of others. Theoretically, he might even come up with an intelligence estimate that risked the fate of his country. You had to be so damned sure of yourself and your data. But you couldn't always be sure, could you? He'd scoffed at many official CIA estimates to which he'd been exposed back at Langley. But it was a damn sight easier to spit on the work of others than it was to produce something better yourself. His Halsey book, tentatively titled Fighting Sailor, would upset a few conventional wisdom apple carts, and deliberately so. Ryan thought that the conventional thinking in some areas was not merely incorrect, but stuff that could not possibly be true. Halsey had acted rightly in some cases where the all-seeing eye of hindsight had castigated him for being wrong. And that was unfair. Halsey could only be judged responsible for the information that was available to him. To say otherwise was like castigating doctors for not being able to cure cancer. They were smart people, doing their best, but there were some things they didn't know yet. They were working like hell to find them out, but the process of discovery took time then, as it was still taking time now, Ryan thought. Was it ever? And Bill Halsey could only know what he was given, or what a reasonably intelligent man might deduce from that information, given a lifetime of experience, and what he knew of the psychology of his enemy. And even then the enemy did not willingly cooperate in his own destruction, did he? That's my job, all right, Ryan thought behind blank eyes. It was a quest for truth, but it was more than that. He had to replicate for his own masters the thinking processes of others, to explain them to his own superiors, so that they, Ryan's bosses, could better understand their adversaries. He was playing shrink without a diploma. In a way, that was amusing. It was less so when you considered the magnitude of the task and the potential consequences of failure. It came down to two words. Dead people. In the basic school at Quantico Marine Base, they'd hammered the same lesson home often enough. Screw up leading your platoon, and some of your Marines don't go home to their mothers and wives. And that would be a heavy burden to carry on your conscience for the rest of your life. The profession of arms attached a large price tag to mistakes. Ryan hadn't served long enough to learn that lesson for himself, but it had frightened him on quiet nights, feeling the roll of the ship on her way across the Atlantic. He'd talked it over with Gunny Tate, but the sergeant, then an elderly man of 34, had just told him to remember his training, trust his instincts, and to think before acting if he had the time, and then warned that you didn't always have the luxury of time. And he'd told his young boss not to worry, because he seemed pretty smart for a second lieutenant. Ryan would never forget that. The respect of a Marine gunnery sergeant didn't come cheaply. So he had the brains to make good intelligence estimates, and the guts to put his name behind them. But he had to be damned sure they were good stuff before he put them out. Because he was betting the lives of other people, wasn't he? The train slowed to a stop. The escalator was working, and there were a few cabs topside. Jack imagined they had the train schedule memorized. "Good evening, Sir John." Jack saw it was Ed Beaverton, his morning pickup. "Hi, Ed." "You know," Ryan said, getting into the front seat for a change, "better legroom." "My name is actually Jack."
"I can't call you that," Beaverton objected. "You're a knight."
"Only honorary. Not a real one. I do not own a sword." "Well, only my Marine Corps one, and that's back home in the States.
And you were a lieutenant, and I was only a corporal."
"And you jumped out of airplanes. Damned if I ever did anything that stupid, Eddie."
"Only 28 times.
Never broke anything," the taxi driver reported, turning up the hill.
"Not even an ankle?"
Just a sprain or two.
The boots help with that, you see," the cabbie explained.
"I haven't learned to like flying yet. Damned sure I'll never jump out of an airplane." No, Jack was sure he never would have opted for force recon. Those Marines just weren't wired right. He'd learned the hard way that flying over the beach in helicopters was scary enough. He still had dreams about it. The sudden sensation of falling and seeing the ground rush up. But he always woke up just before impact, usually lurching up to a sitting position in the bed and then looking around the darkened bedroom to make sure he wasn't in that damned CH-46 with a bad aft rotor falling to the rocks on Crete. It was a miracle that he and a lot of his Marines hadn't been killed. But his had been the only major injury. The rest of his platoon had gotten away with nothing worse than sprains.
"Why the hell are you thinking about that?" he demanded of himself.
It was more than 8 years in his past. They were pulling up in front of the house in Grisdale Close.
"Here we are, sir."
Ryan handed him his fare, plus a friendly tip. "The name's Jack, Eddie."
"Yes, sir.
I'll see you in the morning."
"Roger that."
Ryan walked off, knowing he'd never win that battle. The front door was unlocked in anticipation of his arrival. His tie went first as he headed to the kitchen.
"Daddy!"
Sally fairly screamed as she ran to his arms. Jack scooped her up and gave and got a hug.
"How's my big girl?"
"Fine."
Kathy was at the stove, fixing dinner. He set Sally down and headed to his wife for a kiss.
"How is it," her husband asked, "that you're always home first? At home, you're usually later."
"Unions," she replied.
"Everybody clocks out on time here, and on time is usually pretty early.
Not like Hopkins. Where," she didn't add, "just about everyone on the professional staff worked late."
"Must be nice to work banker's hours."
"Even Dad doesn't leave his office this early, but everybody over here does. And lunch means a full hour, half the time away from the hospital."
"Well," she allowed, "the food's a little better that way."
"What's for dinner?"
"Spaghetti."
And Jack saw that the pot was full of her special meat sauce. He turned to see a baguette of French bread on the counter.
"Where's the little guy?"
"Living room."
"Okay." Ryan headed that way. Little Jack was in his crib. He'd just mastered sitting up. It was a little early for that, but that was fine with his dad. Around him was a collection of toys, all of which found their way into his mouth. He looked up to see his father and managed a toothless smile. Of course, that merited a pickup, which Jack accomplished. His diaper felt dry and fresh. Doubtless, Miss Margaret had changed him before scooting off. As always, before Jack made it home from the shop. She was working out fairly well. Sally liked her, and that was the important part. He set his son back down, and the little guy resumed playing with a plastic rattle and watching the TV, especially the commercials. Jack went off to the bedroom to change into more comfortable clothes, then back to the kitchen.
Then the doorbell chimed, much to everyone's surprise. Jack went to answer it.
"Dr. Ryan?" the voice asked in American English. It was a guy of Ryan's height and general looks, dressed in a jacket and tie, holding a large box.
"That's right.
I got your STU for you, sir. I work comms at the embassy," the guy explained. "Mr. Murray said I should bring this right over."
The box was a cardboard cube about 2.5 feet on a side, and blank, with no printing on it. Ryan let the man into the house and led him directly to his den. It took about 3 minutes to extract the oversized phone from the box. It went next to Jack's Apple IIe computer.
"You're NSA?" Ryan asked.
"Yes, sir. Civilian. Used to be in the Army Security Agency, E5. Got out and got a pay increase as a civilian. Been over here 2 years. Anyway, here's your encryption key." He handed over the plastic device.
"You know how these things work, right?"
"Oh, yeah," Ryan nodded. "Got one on my desk downtown."
"So you know the rules about this.
If anything breaks, you call me." He handed over his card. "And nobody but me or one of my people is allowed to look at the inside. If that happens, the system self-destructs, of course. Won't start a fire or anything, but it does stink some because of the plastic. Anyway, that's it." He broke down the box.
"You want a Coke or anything?"
"No, thanks. Gotta get home."
And with that, the communications expert walked back out the door to his car.
"What was that, Jack?" Kathy asked from the kitchen.
"My secure phone," Jack explained, returning to his wife's side.
"What's that for?"
"So I can call home and talk to my boss."
"Can't you do that from the office?"
"There's the time difference and, well, there are some things I can't talk about there."
"Secret agent stuff," she snorted.
"That's right. Just like the pistol he had in his closet." Kathy accepted the presence of his Remington shotgun with some equanimity. He used it for hunting, and she was prepared to tolerate that, since you could cook and eat the birds, and the shotgun was unloaded. But she was less comfortable with a pistol. And so, like civilized, married people, they didn't talk about it, so long as it was well out of Sally's reach, and Sally knew that her father's closet was off-limits. Ryan had gotten fond of his Browning high-power 9mm automatic, which was loaded with 14 Federal hollow-point cartridges and 2 spare magazines, plus tritium match sights and custom-made grips. If he ever needed a pistol again, this would be the one. He'd have to find a place to practice shooting, Ryan reminded himself. Maybe the nearby Royal Navy base had a range. Sir Basil could probably make a phone call and straighten it out. As an honorary knight, he didn't own a sword, but a pistol was the modern equivalent, and it could be a useful tool on occasion. So could a corkscrew.
"Chianti?" Ryan asked.
Kathy turned.
"Okay. I don't have anything scheduled for tomorrow."
"Kath, I've never understood what a glass or two of wine tonight would have to do with surgery tomorrow. It's 10 or 12 hours away."
"Jack, you don't mix alcohol with surgery," she explained patiently.
"Okay?
You don't drink and drive.
You don't drink and cut, either. Not ever. Not once."
"Yes, doctor."
"So tomorrow you just set glasses prescriptions for people?"
"Uh-huh. Simple day.
How about you?"
"Nothing important. Same crap, different day."
"I don't know how you stand it."
"Well, it's interesting secret crap, and you have to be a spook to understand it."
"Right."
She poured the spaghetti sauce into a bowl.
"Here."
"I haven't got the wine open yet."
"So work faster."
"Yes, Professor the Lady Ryan," Jack responded, taking the bowl of sauce and setting it on the table. Then he pulled the cork out of the Chianti. Sally was too big a girl for a high chair, but still small enough for a booster seat, which she carried to the chair herself. Since the dinner was Pischetti, her father tucked the cloth napkin into her collar. The sauce would probably get to her pants anyway, but it would teach his little girl about napkins, and that, Kathy thought, was important. Then Ryan poured the wine. Sally didn't ask for any. Her father had indulged her once, over his wife's objections, and that had ended that. Sally got some Coca-Cola. Svetlana was asleep, finally. She liked to stay up as long as she could, every night the same, or so it seemed, until she finally put her head down. She slept with a smile, her father saw, like a little angel, the sort that decorated Italian cathedrals in the travel books he used to read. The TV was on. Some World War II movie, it sounded like. They were all the same. The Germans attacked cruelly. Well, occasionally there was a German character with something akin to humanity. Usually a German communist, it would be revealed along the way, torn by conflicting loyalties to his class, working class, of course, and his country. And the Soviets resisted bravely, losing a lot of defiant men at first until turning the tide, usually outside Moscow in December 1941, at Stalingrad in January 1943, or the Kursk Bulge in the summer of 1943. There was always a heroic political officer, a courageous private soldier, a wise old sergeant, and a bright young junior officer. Toss in a grizzled general who wept quietly and alone for his men, then had to set his feelings aside and get the job done. There were about 5 different formulas, all of them variations on the same theme. And the only real difference was whether Stalin was seen as a wise, godlike ruler, or simply wasn't mentioned at all. That depended on when the film had been shot. Stalin had fallen out of fashion in the Soviet film industry about 1956, soon after Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev had made his famous but then secret speech, revealing what a monster Stalin had been. Something Soviet citizens still had trouble with, especially the cab drivers, or so it seemed. Truth in his country was a rare commodity, and almost always one hard to swallow. But Zaitsev wasn't watching the movie now. Oleg Ivanovich sipped at his vodka, eyes focused on the TV screen without seeing it. It had just struck him how huge a step he'd taken that afternoon on the metro. At the time, it had almost been a lark, like a child playing a prank, reaching into that American's pocket like a sneak thief just to see if he could do it. No one had noticed. He'd been clever and careful about it, and even the American hadn't noticed, or else he would have reacted. So he'd just proven that he had the ability to... What? To do what? Oleg Ivanovich asked himself with surprising intensity. What the hell had he done on the metro coach? What had he been thinking about? Actually, he hadn't really thought about it at all. It had just been some sort of foolish impulse. Hadn't it? He shook his head and took another sip of his drink. He was a man of intelligence. He had a university degree. He was an excellent chess player. He had a job that required the highest security clearance, that paid well, and that had just put him at the bottom entry level of the nomenclatura. He was a person of importance. Not much, but some. The KGB trusted him with knowledge about many things. The KGB had confidence in him. But what? He asked himself. What came after the butt part? His mind was wandering in directions he didn't understand and could barely see. The priest. It came down to that, didn't it? Or did it? What was he thinking? Zaitsev asked himself. He didn't really know if he were thinking anything at all. It was as though his hand had developed a mind of its own, taking action without the brain's or the mind's permission, leading off in a direction that he didn't understand. Yes, it had to be that damned priest. Was he bewitched? Was some outside force taking control of his body? No, that was not possible, Zaitsev told himself. That was something from ancient tales, the sort of thing old women discussed, prattled about over a boiling pot.
But why, then, had I put my hand in the American's pocket, his mind demanded of itself, but there was no immediate answer.
"Do you want to be a part of murder?" some small voice asked. "Are you willing to facilitate the murder of an innocent man?"
Was he innocent? Zaitsev asked himself, taking another swallow. Not a single dispatch crossing his desk suggested otherwise. In fact, he could hardly remember any mention of this Father Carroll in any KGB messages during the past couple years. Yes, they'd taken note of his trip back to Poland soon after being elected Pope, but what man didn't go home after his promotion to see his friends and seek their approval of his new place in the world? The party was made up of men, too, and men made mistakes. He saw them every day, even from the skilled, highly trained officers of KGB who were punished or chided or just remarked upon by their superiors in the center. Leonid Ilyich made mistakes. People chuckled about them over lunch often enough, or talked more quietly about the things his greedy children did, especially his daughter. Hers was a petty corruption, and while people talked about it, they usually spoke quietly. But he was thinking about a much larger and more dangerous kind of corruption. Where did the legitimacy of the state come from? In the abstract, it came from the people, but the people had no say in things. The party did, but only a small minority of the people were in the party, and of those, only a much smaller minority achieved anything resembling power. And so the legitimacy of his state resided atop what was, by any logical measure, a fiction. And that was a very big thought. Other countries were ruled by dictators, often fascists on the political right. Fewer countries were ruled by people on the political left. Hitler represented the most powerful and dangerous of the former, but he'd been overthrown by the Soviet Union and Stalin on one side, and by the Western states on the other. The two most unlikely of allies had combined to destroy the German threat. And who were they? They claimed to be democracies, and while that claim was consistently denigrated by his own country, the elections held in those countries were real. They had to be, since his country and his agency, the KGB, spent time and money trying to influence them. And so there, the will of the people had some reality to it, or else why would KGB try to affect it? Exactly how much, Zaitsev didn't know. There was no telling from the information available in his own country, and he didn't bother listening to the voice of America and other obvious propaganda arms of the Western nations. So, it wasn't the people who wanted to kill the priest. It was Andropov, certainly, and the Politburo, possibly, who wished to do it. Even his workmates at the center had no particular bone to pick with Father Carroll. There was no talk of his enmity to the Soviet Union. The state TV and radio had not called out for class hatred against him, as they did for other foreign enemies. There had been no pejorative articles about him in Pravda that he'd seen of late. Just some rumbles about the labor problems in Poland, and those were not overly loud, more the sort of thing a neighbor might say about a misbehaving child next door. But that's what it had to be all about. Carroll was Polish, and a source of pride for the people there, and Poland was politically troubled because of labor disputes. Carroll wanted to use his political or spiritual power to protect his people. That was understandable, wasn't it? But was killing him understandable? Who would stand up and say no You cannot kill this man because you dislike his politics.
The Politburo?
No. They'd go along with Andropov. He was the heir apparent. When Leonid Ilyich died, he'd be the one to take his chair at the head of the table. Another party man. Well, what else could he be? The party was the soul of the people, so the saying went. That was about the only mention of soul the party permitted. Did some part of a man live on after death? That was what the soul was supposed to be, but here the party was the soul, and the party was a thing of men, and little more. And corrupt men at that. And they wanted to kill a priest. He'd seen the dispatches. In a very small way, he, Oleg Ivanovich Zaitsev, was helping. And that was eating at something inside him. A conscience? Was he supposed to have one of those? But a conscience was something that measured one set of facts or ideas against another and was either content or not. If not, if it found some action at fault, then the conscience started complaining. It whispered. It forced him to look and keep looking until the issue was resolved, until the wrong action was stopped, or reversed, or atoned for. But how did you stop the party or the KGB from doing something? To do that, Zaitsev knew, you had, at the very least, to demonstrate that the proposed action was contrary to political theory, or would have adverse political consequences, because politics was the measure of right and wrong. But wasn't politics too fleeting for that? Didn't right and wrong have to depend on something more solid than mere politics? Wasn't there some higher value system? Politics was just tactics, after all, wasn't it? And while tactics were important, strategy was more so. Because strategy was the measure of what you used tactics for, and strategy in this case was supposed to be what was right. Transcendentally right. Not just right at the moment, but right for all times. Something historians could examine in 100 or 1,000 years and pronounce as correct action. Did the party think in such terms? How exactly did the Communist Party of the Soviet Union make its decisions? What was good for the people? But who measured that? Individuals did. Brezhnev, Andropov, Suslov, the rest of the full voting members of the Politburo, advised by the non-voting candidate members, further advised by the Council of Ministers and the members of the Central Committee of the party, all the senior members of the nomenklatura, the ones to whom the resident in Paris shipped perfume and pantyhose in the diplomatic bag. Zaitsev had seen enough of those dispatches, and he'd heard the stories. Those were the ones who lavished presents and status upon their children, the ones who raced down the center lane of the broad Moscow boulevards, the corrupt Marxist princes who ruled his country with hands of iron. Did those princes think in terms of what was good for the Narod, the masses, as they were called, the numberless workers and peasants whom they ruled, for whose good they supposedly looked after? But probably the minor princes under Nikolai Romanov had thought and spoken the same way, and Lenin had ordered them all shot as enemies of the people. As modern movies spoke of the Great Patriotic War, so earlier movies had portrayed them for less sophisticated audiences as evil buffoons, hardly serious enemies, easily hated and easily killed. Caricatures of real people who were all so different from those men who'd replaced them, of course. As the princes of old had driven their troika-harnessed sleds over the very bodies of the peasants on their way to the royal court,
So today, the officers of the Moscow militia kept the center lane open for the new nomenklatura members who didn't have time for traffic delays. Nothing had really changed. Except that the czars of old had at least paid lip service to a higher authority. They'd financed St. Basil's Cathedral here in Moscow, and other noblemen had financed countless other churches in lesser cities, because even the Romanovs had acknowledged a power higher than theirs. But the party acknowledged no higher order. And so it could kill without regret, because killing was often a political necessity, a tactical advantage to be undertaken when and where convenient. Was that all this was? Zaitsev asked himself. Were they killing the Pope just because it was more convenient? Oleg Ivanich poured himself another portion of vodka from the nearby bottle and took another swallow. There were many inconveniences in his life. It was too long a walk from his desk to the water cooler. There were people at work whom he didn't like. Stefan Yevgenievich Ivanov, for example, a more senior major in communications. How he'd managed to get promoted 4 years ago was a mystery to everyone in the section. He was disregarded by the more senior people as a drone who was unable to do any useful work. Zaitsev supposed every business had one such person, an embarrassment to the office, but not easily removed because he was just there, and that was all there was to it. Were Ivanov out of the way, Oleg could be promoted, if not in rank, then in status, to chief of the section. Every single breath Ivanov took was an inconvenience to Oleg Ivanich, but that didn't give him the right to kill the more senior communicator, did it? No. He'd be arrested and prosecuted, and perhaps even executed for murder. Because it was forbidden by law. Because it was wrong. The law, the party, and his own conscience told him that. But Andropov wanted to kill Father Kirill, and his conscience didn't say nay. Would some other conscience do so? Another swallow of vodka. Another snort. A conscience on the Politburo. Even in the KGB there were no ruminations, no debates, no open discussion, just action messages and notices of completion or failure. Evaluations of foreigners, of course, discussions of the thinking of foreigners, real agents or mere agents of influence, called useful fools in the KGB lexicon. Never had a field officer written back about an order and said, "No, comrade, we ought not to do that, because it would be morally wrong." Godorenko in Rome had come closest, posing the observation that killing Kirill might have adverse consequences on operations. Did that mean that Ruslan Borisovich had a troubled conscience as well? No. Godorenko had three sons, one in the Soviet Navy, another he'd heard at the KGB's own academy out on the Ring Road, and the third in Moscow State University. If Ruslan Borisovich had any difficulties with the KGB, any action could mean, if not death, then at least serious embarrassment for his children. And few men took action like that. So, was his the only conscience in KGB? Zaitsev took a swallow to ponder that one. Probably not. There were thousands of men in the center and thousands more elsewhere, and just the laws of statistics made it likely that there were plenty of good men, however one defined that. But how did one identify them? It was certain death or lengthy imprisonment to try to go looking for them. That was the baseline problem he had. There was no one in whom he could confide his doubts, no one with whom he could discuss his worries. Not a doctor, But a priest? Not even his wife, Irina. No. He had only his vodka bottle. And though it helped him think, after a fashion, it wasn't much of a companion. Russian men were not averse to shedding tears, but they wouldn't have helped either. Irina might ask a question, and he wouldn't be able to answer to anyone's satisfaction. All he had was sleep. It would not help, he was sure, and in this he was right. Another hour and two more slugs of the vodka at last drugged him into sleepiness. His wife was dozing in front of the TV. The Red Army had won the Battle of Kursk again, and the movie ended at the beginning of a long march that would lead to the Reichstag in Berlin, full of hope and enthusiasm for the bloody task. Zaitsev chuckled to himself. It was more than he had at the moment. He carried his empty glass to the kitchen, then roused his wife for the trip to the bedroom. He hoped that sleep would come quickly. The quarter liter of alcohol in his belly should help. And so it did. You know, Arthur, there are a lot of things we don't know about him, Jim Greer said. Andropov, you mean? We don't even know if the bastard's married, the DDI continued. Well, Robert, that's your department, the DCI observed with a look at Bob Ritter. We think he is, but he's never brought his wife, if any, to an official function. That's usually how we find out, the DDO had to admit. They often hide their families, like mafia dons. They're so anal about hiding everything over there. And yeah, we're not all that good at digging the information up because it's not operationally important. How he treats his wife and kids, if any, Greer pointed out, can be useful in profiling the guy. So you want me to task Cardinal on something like that? He could do it, I'm sure, but why waste his time that way? Is it a waste? If he's a wife-beater, it tells us something. If he's a doting father, it tells us something else, the DDI persisted. He's a thug. You can look at his photo and see that. Look how his staff acts around him. They're stiff, like you'd have expected from Hitler's staff, Ritter responded. A few months before, a gaggle of American state governors had flown to Moscow for some sub-Rosa diplomacy. The governor of Maryland, a liberal Democrat, had reported back that when Andropov had entered the reception room, he'd spotted him at once as a thug, then learned that it was Yuri Vladimirovich, chairman of the Committee for State Security. The Marylander had possessed a good eye for reading people, and that evaluation had gone into the Andropov file at Langley. Well, he wouldn't have been much of a judge, Arthur Moore observed. He'd read the file, too. At least not at the appeals level. Too interested in hanging the poor son of a bitch just to see if the rope breaks or not. Not that Texas hadn't had a few judges like that once upon a time, but it was much more civilized now. There were fewer horses that needed stealing than men who needed killing, after all. Okay, Robin, what can we do to flesh him out a little? Looks like he's going to be their next general secretary, after all. Strikes me as a good idea. I can rattle some cages. Why not ask Sir Basil what he can do? They're better at the social stuff than we are, and it takes the heat off our people. I like Baz, but I don't like having him hold that many markers for us, Judge Moore answered. Well, James, your protege is over there. Have him ask the question. You get him an STU at home yet? Ought to have gotten there today, yes. So call your lad and have him ask, nice and casual-like. Greer's eyes went to the judge. Arthur? Approved. Lowercase this, though. Tell Ryan that it's for his personal interests, not ours. The admiral checked his watch. Okay, I can do that before I head home. Now, Bob, any progress on Mask of the Red Death? The DCI asked with amusement, just to close down the afternoon meeting. It was a fun idea, but not a very serious one. Arthur,
Let's not discount it too much, shall we? They are vulnerable to the right sort of bullet once we load it in the gun.
Don't talk that way in front of Congress. They might foul their panties, Greer warned with a laugh. We're supposed to enjoy peaceful coexistence with them.
That didn't work very well with Hitler. Stalin and Chamberlain both tried to make nice with the son of a bitch. Where did it get them?
They are our enemies, gentlemen, and the sad truth is that we can't have real peace with them, like it or not. Their ideas and ours are too out of sync for that.
He held up his hands.
Yeah, I know we're not supposed to think that way, but thank God the president does, and we still work for him.
They didn't have to comment on that. All three had voted for the current president, despite the institutional joke that the two things one never found at Langley were communists and Republicans.
No, the new president had a little iron in his spine and a fox's instinct for opportunity. It especially appealed to Ritter, who was the cowboy of the three, if also the most abrasive.
Okay. I have some budget work to do for that hearing with the Senate day after tomorrow, Moore announced, breaking up the meeting.
Ryan was at his computer, thinking over the Battle of Leyte Gulf, when the phone rang. It was the first time for it, with its oddly trilling ringer. He reached in his pocket for the plastic key, slid it into the appropriate slot, then lifted the receiver.
"Stand by," a mechanical voice said. "Synchronizing the line. Stand by. Synchronizing the line. Stand by. Synchronizing the line. Line is secure," it said at last.
"Hello," Ryan said, wondering who had an STU and would call him this late. It turned out to be the obvious answer.
"Hi, Jack," a familiar voice greeted him. "One nice thing about the STU... the digital technology made voices as clear as if the speaker were sitting in the room."
Ryan checked the desk clock.
"Kind of late there, sir."
"Not as late as in jolly old England. How's the family?"
"Mainly asleep at the moment. Kathy is probably reading a medical journal, which was what she did instead of watching TV anyway."
"What can I do for you, Admiral?"
"I have a little job for you."
"Okay," Ryan responded.
"Ask around, casual-like, about Yuri Andropov. There are a few things about him we don't know. Maybe Basil has the information we want."
"What exactly, sir?" Jack asked.
"Is he married, and does he have any kids?"
"We don't know if he's married?"
Ryan realized that he hadn't seen that information in the dossier, but he'd assumed it was elsewhere and had taken no particular note of it.
"That's right. The judge wants to see if Basil might know."
"Okay, I can ask Simon. How important is this?"
"Like I said, casual-like, like it's your own interest. Then call me back from there. Your home, I mean."
"Will do, sir. We know his age, birthday, education and stuff, but not if he's married or has any kids, huh?"
"That's how it works sometimes."
"Yes, sir." And that got Jack thinking. They knew everything about Brezhnev but his dick size. They did know his daughter's dress size, 12, which someone had thought important enough to get from the Belgian milliner who'd sold the silken wedding dress to her doting father, through the ambassador. But they didn't know if the likely next general secretary of the Soviet Union was married. Christ, the guy was pushing 60 and they didn't know? What the hell?
"Okay, I can ask. That ought not to be too hard. Otherwise, how's London?"
"I like it here, and so does Kathy, but she's a little dubious about their state medical care system."
"Socialized medicine? I don't blame her. I still get everything done at Bethesda. But it helps a little that I have Admiral in front of my name. It's not quite as fast for a retired chief bosun's mate."
"I bet. In Ryan's case, it helped a whole lot that his wife was on the faculty at Johns Hopkins. He didn't talk to anyone in a lab coat without professor on his name tag, and he'd learned that in the field of medicine, the really smart ones were the teachers, unlike the rest of society. The dreams came after midnight, though he had no way of knowing that. It was a clear Moscow summer day, and a man in white was walking across the Red Square. St. Basil's Cathedral was behind him, and he was walking against the traffic past Lenin's mausoleum. Some children were with him, and he was talking to them in a kindly way, as a favored uncle might. Or perhaps a parish priest. Then Oleg knew that's what he was, a parish priest. But why in white? With gold brocade, even. The children, four or five each of boys and girls, were holding his hands and looking up at him with innocent smiles. Then Oleg turned his head. Up at the top of the tomb, where they stood for the May Day parades, were the Politburo members. Brezhnev, Suslov, Ustinov, and Andropov. Andropov was holding a rifle and pointing at the little procession. There were other people around. Faceless people walking aimlessly, going about their business. Then Oleg was standing with Andropov, listening to his words. He was arguing for the right to shoot the man. "Be careful of the children, Yuri Vladimirovich," Suslov warned. "Yes, be careful," Brezhnev agreed. Ustinov reached over to adjust the sights on the rifle. They all ignored Zaitsev, who moved among them, trying to get their attention. "But why?" Zaitsev asked. "Why are you doing this?" "Who is this?" Brezhnev asked Andropov. "Never mind him," Suslov snarled. "Just shoot the bastard." "Very well," Andropov said. He took his aim carefully, and Zaitsev was unable to intervene, despite being right there. Then the chairman squeezed the trigger. Zaitsev was back on the street now. The first bullet struck a child, a boy on the priest's right, who fell without a sound. "Not him, you idiot! The priest!" Mikhail Suslov screamed like a rabid dog. Andropov shot again, this time hitting a little blonde girl standing at the priest's left. Her head exploded in red. Zaitsev bent down to help her, but she said it was all right, and so he left her and returned to the priest.
"Look out, why don't you?"
"Look out for what, my young comrade?" the priest asked pleasantly. Then he turned.
"Come, children, we're off to see God."
Andropov fired again. This time the bullet struck the priest square in the chest. There was a splash of blood about the size and color of a rose. The priest grimaced, but kept going, with the smiling children in tow. Another shot, another rose on the chest, to the left of the first. But still, he kept going, walking slowly.
"Are you hurt?" Zaitsev asked.
"It is nothing," the priest replied. "But why didn't you stop him?"
"But I tried," Zaitsev insisted.
The priest stopped walking, turning to look him square in the face.
"Did you?"
That's when the third bullet struck him right in the heart.
"Did you?"
the priest asked again. Now the children were looking at him, and not the priest. Zaitsev found himself sitting up in the bed. It was just before 4 in the morning, the clock said. He was sweating profusely. There was only one thing to do. He rose from the bed and walked to the bathroom. There he urinated, then had himself a glass of water and padded off to the kitchen. Sitting down by the sink, he lit a cigarette. Before he went back to sleep, he wanted to be fully awake. He didn't want to walk back into that dream. Out the window, Moscow was quiet, the streets completely empty. Not even a drunk staggering home. A good thing, too. No apartment house elevators would be working at this hour. There was not a car in view, which was a little odd, but not so much as in a western city. The cigarette achieved its goal. He was now awake enough to go back to sleep afresh. But even now, he knew that the vision wouldn't leave him. Most dreams faded away, just like cigarette smoke. But this one would not. Zaitsev was sure of that.
Chapter 10. Bolt from the Blue. He had a lot of thinking to do. It was as if the decision had made itself, as if some alien force had overtaken his mind, and, through it, his body, and he had been transformed into a mere spectator. Like most Russians, he didn't shower, but washed his face and shaved with a blade razor, nicking himself 3 times in the process. Toilet paper took care of that. The symptoms, anyway, if not the cause. The images from the dream still paraded before his eyes like that war film on television. They continued to do so during breakfast, causing a distant look in his eyes that his wife noticed but decided not to comment on. Soon enough, it was time to go to work. He went along the way like an automaton, taking the right path to the metro station by rote memory, his brain both quiescent and furiously active, as though he'd suddenly split into 2 separate but distantly connected people, moving along parallel paths to a destination he couldn't see and didn't understand. He was being carried there, though, like a chip of wood down mountain rapids, the rock walls passing so rapidly by his left and right that he couldn't even see them. It came almost as a surprise when he found himself aboard the metro carriage, traveling down the darkened tunnels dug by political prisoners of Stalin's under the direction of Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev, surrounded by the quiet, almost faceless bodies of other Soviet citizens, also making their way to workplaces for which they had little love and little sense of duty. But they went to them because it was how they earned the money with which they bought food for their families, minuscule cogs in the gigantic machine that was the Soviet state, which they all purported to serve and which purported to serve them and their families. But it was all a lie, wasn't it? Zaitsev asked himself. Was it? How did the murder of a priest serve the Soviet state? How did it serve all these people? How did it serve him and his wife and his little daughter? By feeding them? By giving him the ability to shop in the closed shops and buy things that the other workers could not even think about getting for themselves? But he was better off than nearly everyone else on the subway car, Oleg Ivanich reminded himself. Ought he not be grateful for that? Didn't he eat better food, drink better coffee, watch a better TV set, sleep on better sheets? Didn't he have all the creature comforts that these people would like to have? Why am I suddenly so badly troubled? The communicator asked himself. The answer was so obvious that it took nearly a minute for him to grasp the answer. It was because his position, the one that gave him the comforts he enjoyed, also gave him knowledge. And in this case, for the first time in his life, knowledge was a curse. He knew the thoughts of the men who determined the course his country was taking, and in that knowledge he saw that the course was a false one, an evil one. And inside his mind was an agency that looked at the knowledge and judged it wrong. And in that judgment came the need to do something to change it. He could not object and expect to keep what passed for freedom in his country. There was no agency open to him through which he could make his judgment known to others, though others might well concur with his judgment, might ask their men who governed their country for a redress of their grievances. No, there was no way for him to act within such system as existed. To do that, you had to be so very senior that before you voiced doubts, you had to think carefully, lest you lose your privilege, and so whatever consciences you had were tempered by the cowardice that came with having so much to lose. He'd never heard of any senior political figure in his country standing up that way.
standing on a matter of principle and telling his peers that they were doing something wrong. No. The system precluded that by the sort of people it selected. Corrupted men only selected other corrupted men to be their peers, lest they have to question the things that gave them their own vast privileges. Just as the princes under the czars rarely, if ever, considered the effect their rule had on the serfs, so the new princes of Marxism never questioned the system that gave them their place in the world. Why? Because the world hadn't changed its shape. Just its color. From czarist white to socialist red. And in keeping the shape, it kept its method of working. And in a red world, little extra spilled blood was difficult to notice. The metro carriage stopped at his station, and Zaitsev made his way to the sliding metal door, to the platform, left to the escalator, up to the street on a fine, clear, late summer day. Again, part of a crowd, but one that dispersed as it moved. A medium-sized contingent walked at a steady pace toward the stone edifice of the center, through the bronze doors and past the first security checkpoint. Zaitsev showed his pass to the uniformed guard, who checked the picture against his face and jerked his head to the right, signaling that it was all right for him to enter the vast office building. Showing the same lack of emotion as he would any other day, Zaitsev took the stone steps down to the basement level through another checkpoint and finally into the open bay work area of the signal center. The night crew was just finishing up. At Zaitsev's desk was the man who worked the midnight to eight shift, Nikolai Konstantinovich Dobrik, a newly promoted major like himself. "Good morning, Oleg," Dobrik said in comradely greeting, accompanied by a stretch in his swivel chair. "And to you, Kolya. How was the night watch?" "A lot of traffic last night from Washington. That madman of a president was at it again. Did you know that we are the focus of evil in the modern world?" "He said that?" Zaitsev asked incredulously. Dobrik nodded. "He did. The Washington Residentura sent us the text of his speech. It was red meat for his party faithful, but it was incendiary even so. I expect the ambassador will get instructions from the foreign ministry about it, and the Politburo will probably have something to say. But at least they gave me a lively watch to read it all." "They didn't put it on the pad, did they?" "A complete transmission on a one-time cipher pad would have been a nightmare job for the clerks." "No, it was a machine job, thank God," Dobrik replied. His choice of words wasn't entirely ironic. That euphemism was a common one, even at the center. "Our officers are trying to make sense of his words even now. The political department will be going over it for hours. Days, more likely. Complete with the psychiatrists, I wager." Zaitsev managed to chuckle. The back and forth between the head doctors and the field officers would undoubtedly be entertaining to read. And, like good clerks, they tended to read all of the entertaining dispatches. "You have to wonder how such men get to rule major countries," Dobrik observed, standing up and lighting a cigarette. "I think they call it the democratic process," Zaitsev responded. "Well, in that case, thanks be for the collective will of the people as expressed through the beloved party." Dobrik was a good party member, despite the planned irony of his remark, as was everyone in his room, of course. "Indeed, Kolya. In any case," Zaitsev looked over at the wall clock. It was 6 minutes early. "I relieve you, Comrade Major." "And I thank you, Comrade Major." Dobrik headed off to the exit. Zaitsev took the seat, still warm from Dobrik's backside, and signed in on the timesheet, noting the time. Next, he dumped the contents of the desk ashtray into the trash bucket. Dobrik never seemed to do that, and started a new day at the office. Relieving his colleague had been a rote process, if a pleasant one. He hardly knew Dobrik, except for these moments at the start of his day. Why anyone would volunteer for continuous night duty mystified him. At least Dobrik always left a clean desk behind, not one piled up with unfinished work, which gave Zaitsev a few minutes to get caught up and mentally organized for the day. In this case, however, those few minutes merely brought the images that, it seemed, were not about to go away. And so Oleg Ivanovich lit up his first work cigarette of the day and shuffled the papers on the metal desk while his mind was elsewhere, doing things that he himself didn't want to know about just yet. It was 10 minutes after the hour when a cipher clerk came to him with a folder. "From Station Washington, Comrade Major," the clerk announced. "Thank you, Comrade," Zaitsev acknowledged. Taking the manila folder, he opened it and started leafing through the dispatches. Ah, he thought, this Cassius fellow had reported in. Yes, more political intelligence. He didn't know the name or face that went along with Cassius, but he had to be an aide to a senior parliamentarian, possibly even a senator. He delivered high-quality political intelligence that hinted at access to hard intelligence information. So, a servant to a very senior American politician worked for the Soviet Union, too. He wasn't paid, which made him an ideologically motivated agent, the very best sort. He read through the dispatch and then searched his memory for the right recipient upstairs. Colonel Anatoly Grigorievich Fokin, in the political department, whose address was Washington Desk, Line PR, 1st Department, 1st Chief Directorate, up on the 4th floor. Outside of town, Colonel Ilya Fedorovich Bubovoy walked off his morning flight from Sofia. To catch it, he'd had to arise at 3 in the morning, an embassy car taking him to the airport for the flight to Moscow. The summons had come from Alexei Rozhdestvensky, whom he'd known for some years and who had shown him the courtesy to call the day before and assure him that nothing untoward was meant by this summons to the center. Bubovoy had a clear conscience, but it was nice to know, even so. You never could be sure with KGB. Like children called to the principal's office, officers were often known to have a few upper gastric butterflies on the way into headquarters. In any case, his tie was properly knotted, and his good shoes shined properly. He did not wear his uniform, as his identity as the Sofia resident was technically secret. A uniformed sergeant of the Red Army met him at the gate and led him out to a car. In fact, the sergeant was KGB, but that wasn't for public knowledge. Who knew if CIA or other Western services had eyes at the airport? Bubovoy picked up a copy of Sovietsky Sports at a kiosk on the walk out to the car. It would be 35 minutes in. Sofia's soccer team had just beaten Moscow Dynamo 3-2 a few days before. The colonel wondered if the local sports writers would be calling for the heads of the Moscow team, couched in appropriate Marxist rhetoric, of course. Good socialists always won. But the sports writers tended to get confused when one socialist team lost to another. Foley was on the metro as well, running a little late this morning. A power failure had reset his alarm clock without formal notice, so he'd been awakened by sunlight through the windows instead of the usual metallic buzz. As always, he tried not to look around too much, but he couldn't help checking for the owner of the hand that had searched his pocket. But none of the faces looked back at him. He'd try again that afternoon on the train that left the station at 17:41, just in case. In case of what? Foley didn't know, but that was one of the exciting things about his chosen line of work. If it had been just happenstance, all well and good. But for the next few days, he'd be on the same train, in the same coach, standing in much the same place. If he had a shadow, the man wouldn't remark on it. The Russians actually found it comforting to trail someone who followed a routine. The randomness of Americans could drive them to distraction. So he'd be a good American and show them what they want, and they wouldn't find it strange. The Moscow chief of station shook his head in amazement. Reaching his stop, he took the escalator up to the street level, and from there it was a short walk to the embassy, just across the street from Our Lady of the Microchips and the world's largest microwave oven. Foley always liked to see the flag on the pole, and the Marines inside, more proof that he was in the right place. They always looked good in their khaki shirts over dress blue uniform trousers, holstered pistols, and white caps. His office was as shabby as usual. It was part of his cover to be a little on the untidy side. But his cover did not include the communications department. It couldn't. Heading embassy comms was Mike Russell, formerly a lieutenant colonel in the Army Security Agency. ASA was the Army's own communications security arm, and now a civilian with the National Security Agency, which officially did the same for the entire government. Moscow was a hardship tour for Russell. Black and divorced single, he didn't get much female action here, since the Russians were notoriously dubious of people with dark skin. The knock on the door was distinctive.
"Come on in, Mike," Foley said.
"Morning, Ed."
Russell was under 6 feet, and he needed to watch his eating by the look of his waist. But he was a good guy with codes and comms, and that was sufficient for the moment.
"Quiet night for you."
"Oh?"
"Yeah, just this."
He fished an envelope out of his coat pocket and handed it over.
"Nothing important, looks like."
He had also decrypted the dispatch. Even the ambassador wasn't cleared as high as the head of communications. Foley was suddenly glad for Russian racism. It made Mike that much less likely to get turned. That was a scary thought. Of all the people in the embassy, Mike Russell was the one guy who could rat everyone out, which was why intelligence services always tried to corrupt cipher clerks, the underpaid and spat-upon people who had enormous information power in any embassy. Foley took the envelope and opened it. The dispatch inside was lower than routine, proof positive that CIA was just one more government bureaucracy, however important its work might be. He snorted and entered the paper into his shredder, where rotating steel wheels reduced it to fragments about 2 centimeters square.
"Must be nice to get your day's work done in 10 seconds, Russell observed with a laugh.
"Wasn't like that in Vietnam, I bet."
"Not hardly.
I remember once one of my troops DF'd a VC transmitter at MACV headquarters, and that was one busy night."
"Get him?"
"Oh, yeah," Russell replied with a nod.
"The locals were seriously pissed about that little dink. He came to a bad end, they told me."
Russell had been a first lieutenant then. A Detroit native, his father had built B-24 bombers during World War II, and had never stopped telling his son how much more satisfying that had been than making Fords. Russell detested everything about this country. They didn't even appreciate good soul music. But the extra pay that came with duty here, Moscow was officially a hardship posting, would buy him a nice place on the Upper Peninsula someday, where he'd be able to hunt birds and deer to his heart's content.
"Anything to go out, Ed?"
"Nope, not today. Not yet, anyway."
"Roger that. Have a good one."
And Russell disappeared out the door.
It wasn't like the spy novels. The job of a CIA officer was composed of a good deal more boredom than excitement. At least 2/3 of Foley's time as a field officer was taken up with writing reports that somebody at Langley might or might not read, and or waiting for meets that might or might not come off. He had case officers to do most of the street work because his identity was too sensitive to risk exposure, something about which he had to lecture his wife on occasion. Mary Pat just liked the action a little too much. It was somewhat worrying, though neither of them faced much real physical danger. They both had diplomatic immunity, and the Russians were assiduous about respecting that, for the most part. Even if things should get a little rough, it would never be really rough. Or so he told himself.
Good morning, Colonel Bobovoy, Andropov said pleasantly without rising.
Good day to you, Comrade Chairman,
the Sofia resident replied, swallowing his relief that Rozhdestvensky hadn't lied to him. You could never be too careful after all, or too paranoid. How go things in Sofia? Andropov waved him to the leather seat opposite the big oak desk.
Well, Comrade Chairman, our fraternal socialist colleagues remain cooperative, especially with Turkish matters.
Good.
We have a proposed mission to undertake, and I require your opinion of its feasibility.
The voice stayed entirely pleasant.
And what might that be? Bobovoy asked.
Andropov outlined the plans, watching his visitor's face closely for his reaction. There was none. The colonel was too experienced for that, and besides, he knew the look he was getting.
How soon? He asked. How quickly could you set things up? I will need to get cooperation from our Bulgarian friends. I know who to go to. Colonel Boris Strokov, a very skillful player in the DS. He runs their operations in Turkey. Smuggling and such, which gives him entree into Turkish gangster organizations. The contacts are very useful, especially when a killing is necessary.
Go on, the chairman urged quietly.
Comrade chairman, such an operation will not be simple. Without a means of getting a gunman into the private residence of the target, it will mean making the attempt at a public appearance, at which there will necessarily be many people. We can tell our gunman that we have